Hello, welcome into the Multifamily Investor Playbook. I'm John McCarowitz, president at Ferris Capital Partners. And today we have a very special guest, William Lawson. So William Lawson has worked with us, sourcing some debt for us, actually some soft pref equity on one of our deals, but somebody who's worked with many of our team members over the years at their prior companies and a trusted source of knowledge and information in the industry. A little bit on William's background. He spent 12 years in the commercial real estate industry, working on tenant representation, underwriting, and debt and equity origination. Today, William works at BWE, and he is responsible for structuring debt and equity financing across a wide range of real estate types for his clients throughout the U.S. Prior to joining BWE in 2022, William was a managing director at Phillips Real Estate Capital for 4 years after having previously worked at CBRE and JLL on the brokerage side. And he's been directly responsible for originating and structuring more than $1.2 billion in real estate transactions located across the country, working with a variety of asset types and capital sources. Real quick, if you're an investor watching this and you're interested in learning more about not only what we do at Ferris Capital Partners, but also just apartment investing in general, go to fulloutinvesting.com. We have a sample deal deck on there, so you can learn a little bit more about the types of deals that we're pursuing. We also have a video that you can watch that walks through our 10-step process on how we find and acquire and exit the best assets in the markets we're looking in. And you can also book in a time to talk at any time with myself or Mark. So William, great to be here today. So thankful that you're willing to join us today. How's everything going?
First and foremost, thanks for having me, John. It's good to be on the podcast. Been following along on the journey, and I'm glad to be here.
Oh, that's so good. Now, we're really fortunate to have your time and expertise today. You know, debt and equity is top of mind for everybody today, right? You know, we've seen rising interest rates, which have created a lot of challenges for operators that perhaps had bridge debt or floating rate debt. And because of that, we've seen, you know, some properties where, you know, in certain markets, we might see, you know, values have dropped 20 to 30% due to the impact on NOI. And so a lot of sellers are challenged, right? So we're seeing deal flow being challenged because of that. And you're also, you know, hearing about all this trillions of dollars in dry powder sitting on the sidelines, right? That investable capital looking for a home. So let's just start with the basics before we kind of go deeper into some of these bigger topics. But what exactly does a debt and equity broker do, and how do you help real estate investors get deals across the finish line?
It's a question I get asked often when I'm out with my wife. It's kind of a hard job to describe, so I'll do my best here. In maybe a couple sentences, we're really a distribution network for borrowers to capital sources. Now, that's kind of a lot in one sentence. Capital sources is a broad term. There's debt and equity. The deals that we've worked on before, there's things between debt and equity in your capital stack, mezzanine debt, preferred equity, co-GP, LP. These are limited partners or co-general partners within your equity stack. And then within the debt, there's a variety of different debt providers. And so we act as a conduit from a group like Ferris or other people that are pursuing multifamily or other product types at BWE. We don't just do multifamily, even though that's what we specialize in. More than half of our business is multifamily investing. However, there are other product types out there, office, retail, self-storage, industrial, et cetera, where we partner the capital sources with the borrowers.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, such a critical component. And to your point, I mean, it's very complex, right? You know, the capital stack, especially on these larger deals, can include many different, you know, sources of debt and equity. And so, you know, we don't need to dive, I think, too deep into that for today's podcast. But I think what's top of mind for a lot of people, certainly today, is just the broader economy, right? We've seen rising interest rates. Inflation has been persistent. You know, we get it a little under control. We're starting to see it bump back up again. But what are you seeing in the market right now in terms of interest rates, loan proceeds, and general lender sentiment?
This is a great question. I've actually not pulled up the 10-year treasury today.
It changes like by the minute sometimes.
It does. Right? Yeah. We're at a 4:30 10-year treasury today. And we've really been hovering around the, you know, 4 to 4.50 on the 10-year and really 3.75 to 4.15 on the 5-year, which is really the two major indices that we track for fixed rate debt. On the floating rate debt, we've got SOFR. And SOFR's held constant at 4.30 for months now. Mm-hmm. right? The Treasury's a bond market, which is going to be impacted by geopolitical components and the economy, where SOFR is more impacted by the overnight banking rate set by the Fed.
Yes.
So, you know, what are we seeing? I think if we had a crystal ball, the background here would be like the Aegean Sea and not an indoor glass wall. It's hard to predict. We certainly feel like rates are going to continue to remain elevated.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a while, a lot of clients and ourselves were optimistic about rate cuts, specifically last year. The kind of everyone thought, hey, how many rate cuts? There are going to be 6 rate cuts. And everyone went into 2024 with this optimism about rates. And so the way that we're advising groups is, let's really do some conservative underwriting and see what kind of loan product works for you today. And if it works and you're hitting a single, that's still really good. It's really hard to hit the kind of returns that people were underwriting really before 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of alluded to it earlier about sponsors being underwater with floating rate debt, and money was really cheap back then. You know, SOFR was 10 basis points, you know, coming out of COVID versus it being 430 basis points today.
Yeah.
So what are we seeing on rates? We think they're going to remain elevated. It's also hard to predict what we know. Right. We don't know. There should be rate cuts in the future. Do we anticipate that rates will go back to where they were? No. I think we're in a new rate environment for the foreseeable future. And that's really what the rates were like for most of the 2010s.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think it's amazing how people tend to have short memories, right? Like our current rate environment is sort of, you know, normal. I mean, it's kind of on average where we've been for many years, right? And obviously we had this extended period of low rates. And, you know, I talked to brokers, right? And, you know, you look back and of course with 2020 hindsight, it's easy to see that the market was overheated, but, you know, some people just thought the party would never end, right? And, you know, certainly it did, and it happened quickly with COVID. And so I'm in agreement with you in alignment. You know, you're closer to it and have more expertise in this area, but it just seems to me with so many factors impacting, and you talked about the geopolitical component, but you know, we're seeing a large shift in demographics, right? I mean, I was just watching 60 Minutes this past Sunday, and I mean, Japan, right? I mean, population decline in such a way, and that's not an isolated place. It's happening everywhere. And so not to go too deep on this topic, but it really comes down to when you have fewer people making incomes that can invest in the markets, right? There's going to be less investable money coming into the markets. And therefore, I think we're going to see persistent higher rates. But it's, once again, I think a matter of perspective, right? And just keeping in mind, what we're seeing has actually been somewhat normal. We've just been in this abnormal world of low rates for so long. It's easy to forget, right? So kind of going down that path a little bit further, I mean, we have seen some data come out recently in the US that employment is softening. We're seeing inflation increase a little bit, although not dramatically. We're waiting, obviously, to see the impact of some of these tariffs. Right now, a lot of the companies are absorbing those, it seems. But, you know, anecdotally, I can tell you, I see things get more expensive at the grocery store. I mean, coffee that we bought a month ago is now $5 more a pack this month, right? So with that, do you see that the Fed will do some moderate or lower rate increases throughout this year? I know there's a lot of talk maybe about one or two sort of in the, you know, the coming months, but what is your take on that?
You're putting me on the hot seat because, you know, we had times last year where, and this year where people had written that they had anticipated a rate cut and the Fed came out and said they weren't going to do it.
Right.
You know, I don't have what the probability is because they set those for the rate for the next Fed fund meetings. I personally don't see them cutting in dramatically. And if it's anything, I bet it's 25 basis points.
Yeah.
But for me, and when you think about what we do, is we're more reactionary than predictors.
Yeah.
And so what we try to think about when we're trying to think about the investor is you're underwriting a deal and how does the loan today match your business plan? What is that business plan? And if it's a shorter term hold, then maybe you're getting floating rate debt to take advantage of rate cuts. So you don't know if there's going to be a cut, but if you think that they're likely to go down, which we do, we don't see people increasing rates.
Right.
You might say, okay, we don't necessarily know when they're going to cut, but let's have something that can float down versus fixing it. If your business plan is to hold something long term and the loan works for you today, then fix it.
Yeah, no, makes total sense. And I think you're intelligent in that regard to not, you know, I think it's really an environment where you have to make the best decision given the information you have at that moment. And for us, I know like one of our golden rules is we only use fixed rate debt. Now, if we did floating rate with a cap, that's potentially an option. But where we sit as of this moment on every deal we've done, we've had fixed rate debt. And so it's meant that we've had some deals that we've had to pass on because it couldn't support that debt, right? All the other metrics look good, but it just couldn't support that. And so I guess maybe for us being a newer company that sort of started post a lot of the pain operators went through that were buying a lot at the peak of the market, that's a lesson we've learned, right? Where it's like, gosh, it seems like the floating rate debt is really what nailed these guys, right? And created those challenges. Now, all that said, you know, it's all about what's happening in the moment. So that, you know, it's funny, sometimes reactionary is the right approach. Like what's happening today and where do we think the market will be, but not betting on, you know, massive rate increases or decreases that we have no way of knowing. In my experience, it seems like as I look back, I'm getting older now, I'm in my mid 40s. And it's like, it seems like nobody really knows what's going on. It's just when something happens, we look back and we find the one or two people that kind of predicted it right. You go, see, all the signs were there, right? But, you know, it's kind of that idea that sometimes you just have to make the decision based on what's happening today. And that's for us why we like the fixed rate debt, because if a deal supports it today, it'll theoretically continue to support it going forward. So kind of really nice dovetail into the next question I had for you. But, you know, working with a multifamily operator, how do you approach structuring debt and equity on an apartment acquisition? And what makes a deal most attractive to lenders and or capital partners, you know, investors, in other words?
This is probably my favorite part of the job, is every deal is different. And every day when you are working in the debt and equity space is different. We're never at cruising altitude. It's always choppy. You're doing something different. So how do you structure it? The first question is what's the business plan?
Mm-hmm.
And understanding the client's business plan, understanding their goals and objectives for the property, as well as the investor. Is this something that the investor plans on having a long-term hold on? Is it a shorter term hold? What are they trying to do to the property? Are they trying to renovate it? Right? And so depending on the business plan, in addition to the size of the deal, and then in addition to that, the location of the deal, we can then start to formulate what a proper loan would look like that can ideally mirror and best help the sponsor execute that business plan. So if you came to me and said, William, you know, we want to buy this and we want to renovate it, we'd want to understand how long does the renovation take? How much money, you know, per unit are you going to be renovating? Are you going to be raising that money from outside investors? Do we need the capital partner to be able to provide that money for you in order to do the renovation? And then what's the exit strategy? Really, really do a strong look at what we think the exit's going to be. You made the nice point earlier, John, about people taking on floating rate debt. You guys are focused on fixed rate, and that's really what's hurting them today. They didn't predict what the exit was going to look like, right? They went in and they borrowed with really cheap money. The rates are up, you know, hundreds of percents today. And they didn't foresee that the next buyer of the real estate was going to have a much higher borrowing cost, in addition to rents not going up and in operating expenses going up, particularly insurance, as you know, and real estate taxes.
Yeah.
So what, you know, how do we structure the loan? We really have to take into account all of those components, from business plan, hold strategy, what we think a reasonable exit's going to be, who is the next buyer if there is one, and then we can have a thoughtful conversation with our client about who we want to go out to market to and what kind of lenders do we want to talk to.
Yeah.
You also mentioned what's most attractive. You know, kind of a little tongue in cheek here, but anything with positive cash flow.
Right.
right.
Yes.
And a lot of the deals that we see, we actually don't have a cash flow problem. We have a value problem.
Mm.
A lot of these deals have positive cash flow. People are paying rent and the property's operating well. The problem is that we can't get the amount of loan proceeds to support the valuation of either the seller or what the client believes it's worth today for a refinance.
Yeah.
And so you would actually know this better than I do. There continues to be this bid-ask gap between sellers and buyers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in terms of what's attractive to a lender today, it's a deal that sizes well to their loan parameters.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. You kind of actually, you know, mentioned one of our other second, you know, we have three golden rules, but the second is we only buy deals that cash flow on day one. But you're right. I mean, gosh, we talk to brokers all the time. And, you know, I was touring a deal in Smyrna, as you know, market just north of Atlanta, where the Braves Stadium actually is. So this particular asset's like a mile and a half from the Battery, which is the huge live, work, play, you know, area built around the stadium, a lot of great population growth metrics were all looking really well. And, you know, just, it was actually not this deal I'm talking about, but in talking with the broker, you know, just gosh, how many deals are falling apart at the last minute. And we're even seeing situations where, I mean, I have a friend who's a commercial broker in Florida who got a full price deal, you know, across the goal line, and then the sellers changed their mind at the last minute. Right. And so it's so challenging these days to not only, you know, find the right deal and then get it under contract, but then layer in the appropriate, you know, debt and make the deal really work. So, you know, we like it because I've found, at least in my experience in business, William, is that actually some of our biggest growth moments at my prior company, Mark Spain Real Estate, were during the Great Recession and even post pandemic, right? And it's looking for those opportunities where you can find them, being patient, being disciplined. And for us, what that looks like at Ferris Capital is with our buy box and the idea that it takes 300 deals. We have to get 300 deals sent to us, whether directly marketed to the broader buyer community or off market, to find one that we can put under contract, right? And so, you know, it's tempting sometimes, William, you know, where you're like, oh, it's close enough. Can it work? And then, you know, thankfully we, you know, take some time to think on it. We're like, nope, it doesn't have XYZ. We can't do this deal. What you just mentioned there, though, the depth of knowledge and awareness that you have to have around, you know, not only just the deal itself, the property, the, you know, seller's financials, but also forward looking into the business plan, right? And it really, you know, dovetails nicely into my next question, right? You know, how important is broker and lender rapport in today's market? And what advice would you give to newer operators trying to get traction with lenders or investors?
I don't think it's ever been more important than it is today. And I've been doing this for over a decade. There's just so many deals out there right now, you know, commercial real estate and multifamily investing. You know, we have a housing problem in the United States. And so there's a reason why people continue to build and invest in multifamily. And it's a product type that's very resilient and it continues to grow. And so there's so many deals out there. How do you get a lender to focus on your deal? Mm. You just said that you're essentially reviewing almost a deal a day.
Yep.
If you call some of these life insurance companies, banks, the agencies, you know, Fannie and Freddie are on track to do $75 billion each in business this year.
Right.
How do you get their attention? Right. Some of our life insurance company correspondent relationships, they get sent 3 to 10 deals a day.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of how important is the relationship, you want to know that certainly if you are hiring a broker, that they can pick up the phone and call their lender and they're going to answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have developed that kind of rapport with them. They know that we're bringing them good business, that it's a good deal with a good sponsor, and that we kind of provide that validation for the lender. It kind of opens up the door and that lets them want to spend time on our clients' deals. And then kind of importantly for you as a borrower, having that kind of reputation and those relationships in the market just pays you dividends on a surety of execution, know that you're getting a good deal and that you're going to have a, you know, not every deal is always so smooth, but you'll have a smoother process than one where you didn't have a strong relationship or you didn't hire a broker that had that rapport with that lender.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, relationships in my mind are the most critical factor in business. You know, I would say the team that you build, but that's relationships as well. It's human capital, right? But building those great relationships and even from the operator to the broker, right? Or the lender level, like really understanding what they want and then having that kind of rapport where, you know, if we come to you, you know how we do business. You generally understand what our business plan is. Each deal is a little unique, but we generally follow that value add strategy and You know, so that deep knowledge and understanding of how we operate, and then making sure that you're finding us the right debt, you know, that will work best for that deal. So critical. So this actually, once again, it's kind of a good segue into the next question. But, you know, what are some common mistakes you see operators or sponsors make when trying to line up financing, and how can they avoid them?
I hope I don't get in trouble in here for you know, saying anything that's happened in the past and someone catches on that I'm talking about them.
Yeah, sure.
I think one of the bigger mistakes is not taking the deal that you have, but thinking it could be better. So what I mean by that is you're marketing a deal and you get a quote, and the quote works for your acquisition or your refinance or your develop. It works for you. However, your eyes get big, you think that there could be something better out there. The old adage of the bird in the hand versus two in the bush.
Right.
And once someone knows, and you can kind of feel this too personally, if a lender feels like you're shopping their deal because you're just trying to make it better than what they already presented to you, they're not going to like that. And you're going to start to waste time. And, you know, my dad used to say that the natural state of every deal is dead. A lot of people say time kills all deals.
Yeah.
And so the longer you take to actually execute on something when you have momentum, because you think you can improve upon it, obviously you want to do, you know, this is my job. We want to go out to the market, get the best possible terms and deliver the best execution for our client. It's when you go beyond that time frame and you kind of start jerking the chain of the lender or the capital source. And you probably know this from raising capital yourself. You want to know if someone's committing or not, and they shouldn't really be fighting you for the last basis point or the last something else. So I would have said a big red flag and things to avoid is if you have a good lender that you like, that has a reputation, take it, because execution risk to me is much more valuable than the last 10 basis points on rate.
Yeah.
Or the last 100,000 on proceeds. I'd rather have a smooth landing than a fast one.
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
No, yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's interesting, right? Because you mentioned the 10-year treasury at 4.3. And, you know, there's been some days where it's fluctuating so dramatically day to day. And, you know, you see, like, maybe, for example, our 5-year treasury on a recent deal, you know, it was down to 3.8. And it's like, you know, do you wait a couple of days to rate lock, or do you just go ahead and rate lock today? It works today. And do we just you know, meet as an investor committee and we all make that decision together, working alongside our broker or our lender. But, you know, sometimes it's like, if the numbers work today, better to lock today. And in this particular case, it's actually a deal we're closing on soon. Within a couple of days, it was back up, you know, to almost 4, right? And you're like, God, I'm glad we locked, you know, but we were looking at the news and there was some indication maybe they'll dip again, right? And so that bird in hand is worth more than two in the bush is definitely appropriate.
Yeah. And I can tell you from, the clients of ours who do not have any refinance risks today are the ones that bought deals or own properties with fixed rate debt with actually amortizing loans.
Yeah.
And so they are taking the conservative approach. They're, you know, amortization is really just deferred equity.
Right.
And it really protects you for what's coming in the future. And so, in terms of red flags, going back to it, another one would be max leverage, max IO, really kind of pushing a pedal to the metal, because you don't know what the next 5 years could hold. And you even mentioned it too, that values are dropping and you're seeing deals in certain markets where the property might be worth the loan amount.
Right.
And so I'm not suggesting that every deal needs to have amortization on it, but if your deal supports amortizing versus the IO, I would take the slightly lower return for kind of the downside protection from your debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to kind of major red flags, I think the one that we kind of laugh at most, and I'm smiling because it happened this week, is buyers believing the sales OM.
Mm. Yeah.
And you know, I can't hate on my sales brethren. They're a very important part of the business. They're kind of the counterpart to us. And everyone oversells, right? Every small town you go to, you walk down Main Street and it says world's best coffee on the side.
That's right.
If it said average cup of Joe, you might not go in.
Yeah.
And so the sales OM is really getting you to get excited and mm-hmm. to spend time. But a lot of it is rosy.
Yes.
And so you really do need to spend your own time with your team. And you guys have done a great job building out a team that knows, hey, let's peel back the onion here and do our own underwriting and focus on what we know and what we can control. And so too many people are putting in bids thinking that they're going to get the execution either on the loan, the debt side, or on the forward-looking projection that the sales OM indicates. I would have said that's a big red flag and one that people should avoid.
Yeah, I had to laugh immediately just because, you know, you see it, right? And you, I think calling it the sales offering memorandum, the OM, right, is so, you know, it's right there in the name, you know, they're trying to sell this deal, right? And so what we often see is pretty aggressive rent growth assumptions, you know, or another area that I've often identified is the comps that they'll use for rent, they stretch a little bit where they might leapfrog over two or three that are like right down the street. And then, you know, in markets like Atlanta, where I live, like I'm so familiar with this market because I've sold residential real estate here for 10, 12 years and then was owned, you know, managed and operated a residential real estate company. And so like, I know every submarket in this market and I've seen the sales OM where it's in Doraville, for example, which you don't need to know Doraville, but a little more industrial, not necessarily a bad market, but you know, they're pulling comps from like Buckhead, you know, which is like one of the highest, you know, dollar areas of Atlanta. And like, yeah, as the crow flies, it's 3-4 miles away, but it's a vastly different market, different schools, you know, everything. And so in our side, we, you know, look at the sales OM, you know, often you can get some good information. I would say generally they're pretty good on the market side, but on the deal, it's definitely rose tinted glasses, right? And so that approach of leveraging it, but almost scrapping it when it comes to your underwriting, using your own rent assumptions, et cetera. I mean, one thing I often see as well is, for example, a building where maybe some value add has already occurred. And so they've largely done like the interiors with the granite or the quartz and the stainless steel, and it looks good. But then they're like, oh, if you just put in, you know, some tile backsplash, you can get 150 more in rent. And you're like, yeah, I don't know about that one. So, yeah, that's a good one. I'm really actually, I didn't expect that one to come up from your side, but I think that is so critical.
So it happened, a deal that we're working on now. Obviously I can't share all the details, but this is a 112 unit property located in the great state of North Carolina.
Okay.
The seller has been, and the sales broker have been trying to sell this for some time. We've been underwriting this deal since probably mid July, right? And we're getting towards Labor Day.
Yeah.
And our client put in an offer. And they really liked it. They did their own underwriting. They've been working with us. They've, you know, toured the market themselves independently. They've talked to people who own down there. They really got a good grasp of what they think is possible with this property. And they put in their offer and the sales broker said, you didn't get it. We're going to go with someone who bid, you know, a million more than you. I was okay. Bummer. Totally get it. You've heard this story a million times. Lo and behold, a couple weeks later, it comes back to our client. And they're saying, hey, if you can really just increase it by 500,000, the deal's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wait a second, you know, why are you coming back to us? So they said, no, we still like your deal. We'll buy it at our original price. Again, a week passes and now they're under contract to buy the property at the price that they put in. And so I think a red flag that it kind of staying on this topic is people stretching. Yeah. I think there's so much fatigue when you, I think you said earlier, John, that you've underwritten 300 deals to get one.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine the kind of level of fatigue that goes with losing. And I'm sure you didn't bid on all 300 properties. No. You're probably, you know, only
about half are probably just outside the buy box. It's sure, more of that ratio, but yeah, I mean, it's
tough.
Takes discipline. Yeah. So
it takes discipline. That's a great way to say it takes discipline to hold your price and not say, oh, we'll increase by a 500,000 because we just finally want to get one under the board and, you know, deploy the capital of our investors that have been really excited. And so I think certainly in this environment with interest rates continuing to fluctuate, there's a lot of geopolitical risk out there. It's hard to know what lies ahead. Kind of hold ground on what you know and be patient.
Yeah, that's it. It's a game of discipline and, you know, right now, for example, we're starting to look at, you know, new markets, right? Because right now our focus in Atlanta, kind of the suburban markets of Atlanta, but Charleston and Tampa, we love those markets and we're still actively pursuing deals there. But in order to increase our hit ratio, we just need more deals. Because if the ratio is 300-1, then we need to figure out how to get, you know, a lot more deals, right? And so I'm actually kind of literally today and over the next few weeks working on a research project, like kind of identifying those top 30 markets. And it's taking that in and of itself will take a few months, you know, and we're leveraging internet sources and broker reports and, you know, candidly, a little element of ChatGPT, you know, just to kind of try to find these little honey holes or these little pockets. And
love the AI.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to hear your approach on it. But, you know, I'm pro. You know, I think that it's all about how you leverage it, not allowing it to do the job for you. But, you know, I find that it's great for idea generation, generally speaking, where I could say, hey, this is what we're thinking about. You know, are there, you know, here's some markets we've identified. Are there other markets that have similar metrics, you know, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I never would have thought of Orem, Utah, but we should take a look, you know?
We use it to either kick off an idea, like, hey, help me think about this.
Yeah.
And you kind of have the thought, but you can't either put pen to paper or you can't formulate how you want to present something, or it's at the very end, you've already done the work product and it's just taken the sandpaper to the statue. It's kind of refining what you've already done.
That's right.
We're a fan of it, and we fully integrated AI into our platform here at PWE.
Yeah. I was just reading an analysis or a little article, I should say, today over at Google. Right. It's they, I guess, had an all hands meeting this week, or maybe it was last week, but you know, letting their team of developers know that, like, if you're not leveraging AI, like, you're going to be out of a job soon. And you know, it was interesting because the article was going on to say their highest paid developers are the ones that know how to leverage AI, but without eliminating their own job by doing it. So I was like, I'd like to learn more about what that actually looks like. But, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, I do have some concerns, right? I think about, you know, how will this impact employment in the future? You know, a lot of jobs. I mean, certainly companies are learning that you can have fewer people, right? And still get the same amount of work done. But I'm also tend to be pretty optimistic about human ingenuity. And, you know, there's been, you know, gosh, industrialization, right? Like these major trend changes to how we do business, how we live our lives, how we produce goods and services. And, you know, gosh, I mean, best business you could have been in the early 1900s was in the horse and carriage business, right? And then all of a sudden it wasn't, it was the worst business you could be in. But what did the automobile industry create? So I do think about that. I don't know the answer, but what jobs will AI help us create, or what new industries, what new technologies, you know? And so I do tend to have that positive outlook, but I do think we have to be cautious, right? But at the same time, it's a great tool for us for sure. Kind of wrapping up, looking ahead a little bit, you know, what trends are you watching when it comes to the debt and equity space over the next 12, you know, say 6 to 12 months? And, you know, what should multifamily investors be keeping on their radar?
What a good question. And we could probably spend a lot of time on this. So let's do the easier one first. The equity space, I think, is a little easier. Certainly from the institutional perspective, all the way down to a friends and family sponsor, people want to buy below replacement cost.
Right.
That's a big theme right now. Let's buy below replacement cost. So let's say that replacement cost is $225,000 to $250,000 a unit, just to put some numbers out there. So you're buying below 250 a unit, you know, as close to 200 as you probably can get. Anything under 200, it's probably older vintage, or you're feeling like you're getting a good deal. The hard part is, if that's the investment thesis of the capital source on the equity side, how does anyone build something new?
Yeah.
Because if you're saying, hey, I want to go out and develop a new product and it's going to cost me, again, the $225 to $250 a door, and you're showing it to a capital partner for a new development, and you're saying, hey, we're going to sell at $325. This goes back to the exit analysis, John, that we were talking about earlier. Right. How does that capital source get excited about their exit being something that they wouldn't pay for today?
Right.
And so we're in this weird world of the return profile is better on the development side. That's always been true, right? There's a reason why developers get paid a lot. They're taking on asymmetric risk for versus buying something that's cash flowing. However, we need to build. And so in terms of what are we watching, we're going to start to see, and we're hoping that we're going to start to see investors get excited about doing developments again.
Yeah.
I think one of the hardest places to raise capital right now is in the true joint venture development space. So that would be my theme for the app for the next 6 to 12 months. How do we see equity get comfortable with a higher exit value on development deals? And we start to see that happen.
Yeah.
On the debt side, I kind of feel like floating rate debt is going to come back. I think that people feel like we've kind of reached the ceiling of where debt and where rates are going to be. So you're not going to have this big swing. You know, what the reason why people got so hurt on floating rate debt previously is because it happened so fast.
Right.
Like it happened before their loan could actually even mature. So if you originated something in 2021 on floating rate debt, let's say it was a 3-year loan, by the time you got to 2024, you had gone from a 10 basis point SOFR to 400 basis point plus SOFR. Mm-hmm. It even got over 500 basis points at one point. And so I think floating rate debt is going to be a product that we see. And then two is the banks. Mm-hmm. There was a long time there in 23 and 24 where banks just really were not actively lending.
Yeah.
We had the collapse of some banks. There's been acquisitions of banks. Banks needed to right-size their portfolio. And I think we're going to see banks, and we're already starting to see it, really become a much more source of capital on the debt side for our clients in 2026.
No, that's huge. And it's interesting, the replacement cost. It's something that I had a bit of a front row view on with the single family rental investors that really came out in the Great Recession period. So a little background for the listener. You know, I was co-founder and president at Mark Spain Real Estate. And it was around 2009-10, all of a sudden we started getting these knocks on our door from these, you know, groups. And they often had generic sounding names. I would Google search them, really couldn't find anything out about them. And we had a number of meetings that never went anywhere. But one day a group called Treehouse Realty Group knocked on our door. That ended up becoming Invitation Homes. Blackstone, one of the largest private equity firms, was backing them. And bottom line is there was America Homes for Rent. There was, Colony Capital. There was a handful of these groups. And now it's, you know, big asset class, right? But in the early days, it was just a handful of these groups. And what was so fascinating is that their model for which single family rentals to acquire, yes, they were looking at, you know, the cap rate and, you know, the rental rates and all those things. But the most important metric was the discount to replacement cost. And it was interesting because we were, you know, brokers for Invitation Homes. And at some point, I mean, we were closing a couple hundred, 400 or 500 a month with them. They ended up owning over 85,000 single family rentals in Metro Atlanta. And so all that said, you know, if you talk to the average real estate agent, they thought these guys were like smoking crack. They're like, can you believe what they're offering on these houses? It's absurd. And in fact, it was funny. One of our contractors with Syntex, he's kind of our GC at the property level. We were catching up and he was actually working for Invitation Homes at the time, but he's also a real estate investor. And he's like, man, it was making me angry. I just couldn't believe what they were paying for these homes. And we were just talking about, gee, we wish we bought a lot of them too, because they were dead on. Right. And so it's something we talk a lot about at Ferris Capital. It's like, what is that replacement cost? What is that discount? So, you know, our model is kind of based on NOI, right? And that's kind of how we're coming to our valuation. But we look at that discount to replacement cost as another key metric. Because, you know, you nailed it, right? At the end of the day, if it costs a certain amount, $225, $250 to deliver a new unit, and we can buy it at an extreme discount, when development starts going again, you know, that'll, in a sense, help pull up the value of our building. So that's a really big metric. But it was fun, you know, going back and thinking on those days, because even I was like, man, these guys are out of their mind some days. You know, the stuff they were paying overpriced, full price for, et cetera. But I don't think anybody would look back and say they made a bad bet. You know, they absolutely knew what they were doing. So that's a key metric that I'm so glad you mentioned, because it's one that we employ here at Ferris Capital. So, William, this was fantastic. Like, I think there was so much knowledge and information here. I know before we started recording, we were laughing, like we could probably talk for hours. So, you know, perhaps in a few months, maybe we'll even try to see if you have some time to come back and dig in deeper. And not holding you to predictions, but we'll see maybe if some of those came through. But I do tend to agree with you. I think the Fed, if they do any rate cuts, they'll be very low to moderate. And, you know, it's just understanding this is the new normal, you know, and, you know, maybe in the future we'll get some relief. But, you know, if the deals work today, then they should work tomorrow. And that's kind of how we're approaching it at Ferris Capital. Once again, if you like what you heard today or you're interested in learning more about investing in apartments in the U.S., go to fulloutinvesting.com. Once again, sample deal deck and a 50-minute video that walks you through our process for identifying the best investments. A little pro tip, you can watch it at 1.5 speed. Maybe it'll sound a little like chipmunks, but you can get through it faster. But really good information in there that'll help you understand, once again, our process while also giving you a broader knowledge of apartment investing in general. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Multifamily Investor Playbook. If you like what you heard, please like and subscribe and share with other high net worth individuals. We love and believe in you. Have a great day.